Mark, would you please call us to order?
Roll call. Joyce Dill. David Happ. Cheryl Hanley Maxwell. Michael Smith. Deb Roosh.
Here.
We have a quorum.
Are there any additions to the agenda today? No? Okay. Any citizen input, public participation? We have a full agenda today, so I'm assuming that everybody's saving their voices for later on. Okay, moving ahead to mental health. Board input. We don't have a representative from the Mental Health Board here unless there's something that you'd like to share with us today, Mark.
Mental Health Board is in the same stage of the process. The board will meet next week, next Wednesday at 5:30, and going through the same process you'll be going through today. So.
On page 3 of the packet, the minutes of our previous meeting begin. I'm looking for a motion to approve.
I move we accept these as presented.
I'll second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, the board meeting minutes are approved as presented from the March 22nd meeting. Okay, since we have such a full agenda today, so many people that are going to probably speak about their programs, I just want to keep it short. I did want to make a comment about our reviewer. I'm sure in reading through the program summaries, you've all noticed that our reviewer had some interesting comments about many of the programs, and I just wanted to introduce her. She's not here, but I'll let you know who she is. Her name is Vanessa Matheny. She's from Oak Park. She has a Master of in Social Work, and she's a licensed social worker. She works for a 708 board with contracts for IDDD supports and services. And all of their contracts are fee-for-service. You may have noticed that there were several comments from Vanessa regarding the worry of Medicaid supplementation. And some of that worry comes from the fact that they've had a lot of Medicaid supplementation problems in Oak Park, and they've had considerable input from the state and instruction by the state on how to deal with that. So some of her language is very cautionary to us in there because of their experiences. Lynn, do you have a report?
I'm also glad to see a full house, and I think we've agreed that we'd like to have the agencies take a minute to speak to their applications as we go through the program summaries.
Okay, item 10, agency information.
We've hit the point where I can say good afternoon. Patty Walters from DSC. And because we have so many applications, and you're going to hear you probably have specific questions about some of the apps, we were also, I think, collectively as providers suggested to use the agency information just to kind of overview if there's anything. So I just wanted to clarify a couple things, in part because of a couple of the reviewer comments. So you probably are much more in tune and closer to how the funding is for the programs than the reviewer was, but I just wanted to clarify based on a couple of things. And I'm going to kind of read a little bit, so I apologize for that. But The part of it was to clarify the interdependence between a few of the applications. So the Employment First application is the collaboration with Community Choices and DSC, and that one doesn't do any direct service but has is establishing the infrastructure, which has the four focus areas of the stakeholders are the people receiving services, families, businesses, the staff at DSC, as we kind of shift away from the in-house and sheltered work. And then Employment First is that collaboration with moving services to the community. And just, you know, as a sidebar, that's happening much faster for people that are county-funded than it is for people that are state-funded as a result of the funding that we get from this board. As a result of those eFirst efforts, the progress toward the transformation is noticeably visible through a shift in priority and funding. So there is the request is for $125,000 from the Integrated Community First Program to community employment. And I think that was a little bit confusing. We're not asking for an increase in one program. It's not new money. It's cost neutral. And it's the integrated in-house program shifting funding to community employment. So that's the main thing that I wanted to clarify. It's cost neutral, and it's continued the commitment and interdependence of community experience and employment to allow that transition without an interruption or discontinuation of services for people that are in those day work programs now. The applications, if they're looked at collectively, it becomes easier to understand that connection and that the shift is really kind of just planfully transitioning away from the current model to, well, I would say current, but I don't think it's really current anymore, the model that we've had in the past, and we've done a lot in the last year and a half to use the Employment First grant to approach the transformation. So since the agenda is full and doesn't have that transition to community part in this month's meeting, I just wanted to share that as new people have been requesting DSC services, the integrated site-based program where people typically in the past have come and wanted to come do the work program and participate in full-day services, that in Annette Becker's part of the community, I'm sorry, Annette Becker's part of that integrated program, it's been over 6 months since anybody has been entered into that work program. So I think that's noteworthy. People are not being necessarily assuming that they get all-day services or that they're getting that work experience, despite that being exactly what some of those requests are for. So in the last 6 months, just highlighting the shift in priority, even when that's exactly what some people are asking, and trying to be responsive to those that do not want that service anymore. So kind of challenging and exciting at the same time, and hopefully as we go through those applications, it'll be a little bit more clear. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Penny.
So I guess there's no more agency information. I do want to acknowledge to the agencies and apologize. Some of the applications were very, very long. And so for the program summaries, we had to edit quite a bit and in some cases lost some really great writing. I brought the original applications just in case anyone wanted to see the really great writing. But we had to summarize because they're summaries and in order to make them sort of uniformly shorter, but anyway.
Okay, moving on to item 11, we have a financial report, which is on page 7 and 8. I'm going to move that we approve the claims as presented. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The claims are approved as presented. Okay, item number 12. This is the long one. New business. We'd like the agencies to come forward and just give us highlights of your application. We'll start as they're presented in the book. Which is CCRPC Community Services is the first one up.
it on? Good afternoon. So our application is a continuation of last year's funding where we were with an addition. So the first part, the continuation, we have a staff person that does community outreach, making sure that individuals that are not aware of the PUNS registry, making sure that people that are in need of or going to be needing DD waiver services are aware and are registered as early as possible. So we make sure that the community is aware of that service and then all for services. The other thing that is done with that staff person and those funds is to inform the board of preference of individuals in our area. So not what services exist, so not just choosing in what exists, but advising on what services they would want to see in our area. So we call them preference assessments, and that information is then shared with the board to help inform you of services that you may support or fund or going forward for individuals with developmental disabilities. The additional funding that was requested is for transition planning consultants. And so we've heard in different assessments and from the board that there's a gap in service with regard to individuals that are aging out of school and going into adulthood. So we know that there's services while they're in school, but when it's time to transition, sometimes there's this parents, guardians are at a loss and not knowing what the next step is. So the transition planning consultants would work more intensively with the families to make that plan for transition. The idea would be 6 months to at most a year prior to transitioning out of school into adulthood. They would work individually on a case-by-case basis what the families need. Again, that was a complete projection. We don't really know how much need. It would be a fee-for-service type of thing in essence. So that's an overview. Kim, other things that I didn't hit?
Lisa, could you just state your name and the agency?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Since we're just on an audio loop, not video.
Sure. Lisa Benson, Regional Planning Commission. I'm the Community Services Director.
Please. Kim Baldry, ISC Program Manager.
Thank you.
Any questions?
I do. Are the schools doing this? I mean, do they request that kind of service, or is it the school's responsibility to provide that kind of service?
So I'm gonna speak to a little bit, and then I'm gonna turn it over to Kim.
Sure.
So the services, the schools do provide, from what I'm understanding, education and information about the services that exist. We would anticipate this being a family-requested service. So essentially, prior to an IEP, rather than waiting and going to an individual education plan meeting, we would go to the families prior to that. So the schools inform us when IEP meetings are happening. We would go to the family and say, we understand that there's an upcoming individual education plan meeting. We also understand that your child is going to be transitioning. We do have these services. Is that something that you're interested in? If it is something they would be interested in, then that training transition consultant would attend and advocate during IEP meetings, and they'd take the case from there with regard to the more extensive and supportive services. I think the schools are limited in what they're able to do just out of pure numbers, and you can speak more to what the schools are able to do.
We see this as an opportunity for someone to assist the families directly rather than just pointing them to the services and say you need to go do this. This would be here's what you need to do and here's how you go about doing it, kind of making a blueprint for the family and walking through that case with them.
Okay, thanks.
Because that was the one thing, the statute and the school code and potential violations. The other thing, what are you proposing, that this will begin just prior to the first transition IEP or earlier?
Again, we wouldn't want to duplicate school services. It would really be, like I said, I can't imagine doing it more than a year in advance. But again, it would be case by case based on.
Question. Not a question, but in past meetings, we've heard from parents and advocates that this is really a need. So I'm hopeful that this is something that'll fill that need that we've heard from other folks. Thanks.
And I think ideally we would like to see an individual that we contract with, somebody who's walked through the process themselves, so they know exactly what the parents are going through and struggling to figure out the services. So it's not just a person who's never done it, somebody who's actually walked through that, down that path.
And if funded, again, it was a shot in the dark about not knowing how much request would come for such a service. So we would, if we get a lot of requests, the funding will only go so far. So
how do you propose to let families know that the service is available?
Again, what we talked about was prior to an individual education meeting, when that trigger comes, it's time for someone to begin their transition planning. We would reach out to the family to advise them and see if that's a service they were interested in. Not all families are going to necessarily need that type of service.
It seems to me that the contract term protects us a little bit from this blowing up in your face too much, since the IEPs tend to be in the spring, and the contract you'd be applying for a renewal of this contract if it were awarded in February. So you might even next February not know what the need is, right? I mean, you could conceivably discover the need next April.
Right.
So I don't think there's a, if this were grant contract, I don't think the money would be wasted necessarily, because you would probably be spending it on the other activities described here first. This is all like fourth quarter, probably.
Okay, thank you. Next on page 17, we have the cultural and linguistic competence activities for CTF, and then their application follows.
There we go. Hi. Again, good afternoon. My name is Mary Pat Ambrosino. I'm the new CEO of CTF Illinois. And here with me today, I have Melissa McDaniel, our Chief Program Officer, who is responsible for all our IDD activities, and also Tracy Waverling, who is our Regional Network Director, who is responsible for the services and supports in the Champaign County.
Welcome. The first application that we had was for the Advocacy Center. This would be our second year applying for an additional data program option here in Champaign. Although it is a non-traditional type of day program in that what they do during the day is focusing on learning advocacy skills that they're able to take out for themselves or for their community or for the state at a larger level. In some of our other areas, we have successful advocacy centers up and running, and people are gaining income from doing work such as they have trainings that they are going out and training other people, and then that is their income they are getting from it. So some clarification on that. One of the other things that when reading the reviewer's application was an ask about fee for service. Mm-hmm. And we are completely open to switching how we applied for this and going more to a
Am mine's not working.
You had sent a nice clarification yesterday, but I don't know that they all got it. So Mark was going to make a couple of copies for them. Thank you for the extra information.
Okay. Our other application is for our nursing. We have asked for that for several years, and that since Devonshire. Do you guys have any questions regarding that one? Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, next, See You Able, their cultural and linguistic competence activity analysis is on page 27, and the program application begins on 29. This is a new application. Welcome.
Thank you. Hi, my name is Diane Gordon. I'm a board member of See You Able, and this is Amy Slagle, who is also a board member. We are a new organization, a newish organization. We got our 503C application done last December, end of last year. And we are kind of just getting started with a lot of our things. We've been a Facebook parent support group since late 2014, and we're trying to expand on that now to provide more services and events for our constituents. So, what kind of questions do you have, or do I need to tell you more, or I don't know what I'm doing, so.
I just have one question about the mom's retreat.
Yes.
I know that this is not the first year. It was how long has the mom's retreat been active, and how was it funded previously?
Okay, that's a great question. So we have done the mom's retreat here in Champaign for 2 years. It's held in July, and it's usually, we've had it at the Newman Center for the last 2 years, and they've been very kind to us in providing some reduced fees to let us stay there and so forth. So in Champaign, we've been doing it for 2 years. Our previous funding sources were StarNet, at DSN, the Down Syndrome Network, and the Autism Society of Illinois.
And the autism program.
Right. And then DSC as well has helped us out a little bit. And the YMCA, but the YMCA didn't provide funding. They just provided us some meeting rooms and supplies. Right. So those are the people who have...
You might not know this, but I think that most of those sources of funding were actually DDB contracts. I think that DDB contracts with each of those organizations, not TAP, but the others, and that some of the mom's retreat was supported by DDB funding.
Good.
Indirectly.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. So some of those sources are going, like the Autism Society is no longer in service right now, so that source has dried up for us a little bit. So we're just looking to be able to support that for our constituents a little bit more.
And hopefully also give fee waivers to people who need it, or maybe even everyone, transportation support as well. So.
Deb. Just as an aside, there are moms retreats throughout the state that are held throughout the year. We are not involved in the planning of those. This is specifically for the Champaign area. Yeah.
I have a question about, we do fund Down Syndrome Network, and I'm a big supporter of parent support and family support for this. This seems to me that it would be almost a way to go about combining all of those things. I know that each individual disability that we do fund, they do that because there are services that they feel are really necessary for families. When I look at this, I see a lot of different things that fulfill that requirement. One of the things that I have down here is the Facebook. And Facebook, whether we think it's professional or not, is a good way to contact people. I wonder if there are organizations that could be contacted that actually might already be doing some of these things to see if there's a way to cooperate among all of these different parent and family support networks. Because, let's face it, we have very little money. So when we start looking at things that we need to fund to help families, things can sound really good. And I know everyone's heart is in the right place. That's not it at all. It's a lack of funding from the state, from anyone at this point. So I'd really like to know if you foresee any kind of cooperation with other groups that would use this very same thing that you are doing. I think moms retreats are wonderful ideas. I think that moms always need help with a lot of things, and it's really good to talk to someone who has gone through it. I commend that. I think it's very good. I also think it's good if we all advocate in the same way. So,
Down Syndrome Network, not this past year, but the previous year, had a more substantial role in helping us plan the retreats. In addition, and then this year, of course, they or 2016, they helped us with financially. I think our group is more, like you said, with the support and the families. A lot of different diagnoses have similar. We can learn from each other with the different diagnoses. So rather than focusing on one, you know, sharing resources and experiences, we can learn from each other. I guess that's kind of why we are not focused on one. But, yes, in terms of collaborating, we're absolutely open to that.
Okay, thanks.
We do a lot of co-advertising for different events. Like we'll advertise for the Buddy Walk, with the Autism Society, some of their events. So we do some collaboration that way. But and we talked with the autism group when they were kind of splitting up to see if they wanted to combine, you know, where they wanted to go with that. One of our main goals, though, is to keep it a very inclusive group so we don't focus just on one thing, but we focus on the entire journey. So we are absolutely open to collaboration with groups. Yep.
Thank you.
I just have one more question about some of the wonderful things that you provide for the moms, like massages and the craft things. Are you able to find donors? Do you have donors who have donated services and
yes.
Products for that?
Yes. So a couple years ago, we actually went out to Parkland College. They've got a massage clinic, or they teach it there, the therapies and so forth. So we had their students come out, and so they got credit for their classes, and moms benefited from that. We do get some donors for the year before. We were able to get donors for things like dinners, some of the meals and so forth. Last year, and that was in collaboration with Down Syndrome because they had their that tax exempt at that point. We did not have that last year, so we weren't able to get as many donors, and now we've got that in place for this year. So we will be going out and actively seeking donations for that kind of thing.
Great. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Next, Down Syndrome Network.
Nobody here from Down Syndrome Network.
Do you have any questions about? I have the full applications right here. Sometimes they can help.
If you have questions.
Oh, okay. Okay, no questions. We'll move on. Next, Head Start and Early Head Start, page 40.
Good afternoon. I'm Brandy Grants, the Early Childhood Division Director.
And I'm Elise Belknap. I'm the Social-Emotional Development Specialist at Head Start.
Our application is a request for continuation of funding to support a social-emotional development specialist who is a early childhood mental health consultant. The specialist provides support to children experiencing social-emotional delays and behavioral challenges. These are children who do not qualify for special education services. The specialist provides individual support, modeling, and observations in the classroom, so modeling to support the teachers, and also modeling for the children, screenings, evaluations, training for staff, and in some cases, counseling for children and families, and that is based on agencies being able to provide those supports in the community. Our program collaborates with several community agencies who provide special education services for our infants and toddlers, as well as preschoolers, and mental health services. When children and families do not qualify, our specialist does provide those services as needed. Overall, our goal is to get children ready for kindergarten by addressing social-emotional delays and behavioral challenges early. Do you have questions?
Questions, thank you. Nope, one question.
So we actually, they were preparing a written, just additional information, but I told them not to hurry, not to worry about it. But you can certainly do that. During the course of that, I asked you a question about the counseling, mm-hmm. which I thought was provided by the social-emotional specialist, but that's not true. You just said that you contract out to the community.
I can answer that okay. question probably more specifically. we do both depending on the openness and engagement level of the family. So there are certain families who may feel hesitant about engaging in mental health care out in the community, and so that's a good entry point for me to engage that family that may not follow up with calls, may not follow up with appointments, but I have the flexibility in my role to show up, and so I provide some of those when that seems to be the best fit for that family, and then when there is a family that might make better use of those outside agency referrals, then we do that. So it depends on the need and the engagement level of the family.
So we would not be paying for those services under this contract?
No.
So
no, those
also, are... our contracts all require that this be used as the payer of last resort. So if a family has Medicaid, mm-hmm. We would not want to pay for counseling if that counseling can be done by a participating provider.
So when we typically what we might do is make a referral if that family has Medicaid to an outside provider, sometimes because they don't have the relationship, that family might not follow through with that referral. So then they're just not getting services, in which case I might step in and do a short-term kind of relationship building, get them hopefully comfortable with mental health services and what that's like, and then reconnect them to those Medicaid services. So they're not it's not a long-term counseling service. It's more of a crisis intervention, short-term bridging model, so that way they can get connected to those long-term services, but they wouldn't have been doing that on their own for whatever reason.
By the way, I don't have any questions about it. I know how important this is, so thank you for the application.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Next, community choices.
Uh, Hi, I'm Becca Obachowski. I'm the Executive Director of Community Choices. We submitted three applications to the board. One was for our self-determination support program. We sometimes call this our Connect program. The focus of this is to both support individuals with disabilities as well as their families, to be engaged with each other, to be engaged with the community, and to sort of build their social connections as well as their self-advocacy, their knowledge of services and supports that are available in the community. We also do a had a community living and what type of living situation is going to be most ideal for them. And then we spend the next 6 months getting them moved out into the community, finding that community location for them to live, and then begin really sort of working on those skills in the setting where they're going to use them. And then finally, the last year, we continue to build those skills and then help that person reach out, get connected with their neighborhood, with their with friends and other sort of natural supports, so that we can then begin to back away and put our efforts elsewhere. And then finally, we have a customized employment program. And this is a completely community-based employment program. We start with a discovery process where we work with the individual to sort of get to know them, see where they're comfortable, see where their interests lie, sort of work with them as well as their sort of who they identify as their natural supports, whether that be family, friends, personal support workers, or whoever that is, to really figure out what type of environments, what type of interests they most connect to, and then we use that to build a plan to find them a job in the community where they're going to be able to sort of capitalize on those interests and hopefully be successful for a longer sort of ongoing period of time. So then we do job matching, job coaching, and then finally long-term support for folks. As we sort of fade out after they're quite independent on their jobs, we continue to sort of check in, sort of be a liaison between the employee and the employer should any conflicts come up, concerns, or even if the person is looking to increase their role at their job to help learn new skills. We did ask for an increase in funding in two of our programs. One of them was the customized employment. And for this, we wanted to sort of address both the need that transition aid students coming out of school have in order to connect with employment as well as other additional community supports. We wanted to adapt our discovery and job matching process to fit the needs of those folks who are a little bit younger and coming out of the school system. So what we would do here is instead of doing a discovery process that focused just on the individual, we would really focus on the needs and the interests of both the individual, the family, and the school. And so connecting with them, interviewing them, and spending time with them to build that relationship. And then in the meantime, because some of these students may be not quite at that transition point, that 22 years of age, we would help that individual get more connected to their community, get connected with opportunities for self-advocacy, for social opportunities, just sort of to help create a richer natural support system that then once they're out of school, they're going to be able to capitalize on in order to be more successful in whatever job setting they're looking for. And at the same time, we'll work with the family to help to make sure that they understand the service system and are able to connect directly to it and sort of walk them through that process. As we've heard at many of the board meetings and that I hear frequently from the families that I work with, this period when folks are coming out of school, it can be very difficult for people not understanding exactly how things work and transitioning from the entitlement system of the school to the more, the service system that we have here for adults, as well as just kind of understanding the shift in role from being a parent of a student to a parent of a young adult who's going out in the community and looking to make a life for themselves too. And then in the self-determination program, we also we're looking to increase some of our family support. As part of that, doing a family support group where families, some families who maybe have been through the transition process, have been working with the service system for quite some time, can connect with families who are sort of newer to it, newer to the community, and help sort of share some of that knowledge as well as build some of their advocacy skills and just general natural supports for each other. Any questions? Yeah.
I have a couple questions. Yeah. Probably one for each.
Yeah, sorry.
Well, that's fine.
I talk really fast.
I guess since we were talking about self-determination, I think Lynn brought up a good point in her review of the application, mm-hmm. that when you're talking about self-determination, to me that means self-advocates. And then when you involve parents, now they are no longer self-advocates. It's almost like, to me, that seems like that should be two different programs.
That's a fair question, and that was something that we considered too. And actually, our self-determination program is one of the ones that the Mental Health Board chose to work with directly with the UIUC team on the evaluation capacity. And as part of that, we sort of developed this logic model that looks at this program and how do you measure and how do you sort of quantify and look at the programs within that grant. And what we really found was that the self-advocacy and the family support are both sort of like the jumping off point and sort of the end result of the overall idea that in order to go out and to be self-determined and to make decisions about your life, you have to sort of be connected to people and feel like you have that safe community that you can kind of rely on and come back to when you're doing things that are kind of outside your comfort zone. So we sort of see that as sort of the end result of some of the other activities within that program. So there's various entry points. People have their the family meetings that are open to the public, where we share information about our services that are happening in the state, advocacy. We also have social opportunities that are only for individuals with disabilities. And then with that family support, we're able to sort of build that up to get people to be more interested and more connected with social opportunities and self-advocacy. So I think that is certainly something to consider for the future. We felt like it all fell into the same system by working through that program.
Becca, I apologize if this is addressed in the packet, but so if I'm reading this right, you're asking for $99,000 for the customized employment.
Yes.
And is that an increase then over last year, Lynn?
It is.
So bottom line, does that mean you're going to have more staff and there's going to be so many more people served by this? Can you tell me those numbers?
Absolutely, yeah. So we did ask for an increase, and that was almost entirely to pay for an additional half-time staff person to focus on that transition support. And so sort of connecting with stakeholders and developing a program that sort of mirrored our current employment program, but that did take into account sort of the change in circumstances of folks coming out of the school system. So
a lot of it's a huge need. So we, you know, my concern becomes when we read these transition-focused applications, if we aren't duplicating, and so when it involves choice, family choice, individual choice is always good, but if it can be done in the most conflict-free way possible by one particular entity, so to speak. Can you speak to me on how you think your transition component of this application goes beyond the scope of maybe RPCs or what you plan to do differently that they couldn't accomplish?
Sure. Well, and I haven't had the opportunity to read all of RPC's applications, so I can't speak to the details on that. But what I can say is that we're very aware that this is a need within the community and that there are other organizations that are looking to fill this need in whatever capacity. I think one of the things that we wanted to really start with was talking to all of the different stakeholders that that kind of have a say in what they need in transition support. So that includes teachers and students, as well as families and other service providers. So before we put any absolutely definite sort of plans in place about our process, we want to make sure that we can talk to those people for a number of reasons to figure out exactly what it is that they need, as well to make sure that we're not duplicating services and so that we can make sure that when we are talking to families or talking to schools, that we are very aware of what else is available, and making sure that we can connect people to that. I think in working with the family portion of it, what we really want to do is make sure that they are aware of all of the different resources that are out there, and not necessarily to say, like, well, you can come with us and we will work with you in employment, although that is one option, but to say that, you know, these are what's available in our community in terms of employment, and we're happy to help you connect and be knowledgeable and sort of a good advocate for yourself and for your child.
So this is a related question. If the DD board discovered that had enough money to fund all of the, there are, I think, three new pieces related to transition and then some existing pieces that are related to transition. So if they were to say they wanted to fund all of those pieces, how would you approach coordination across all the different providers who are interested? I mean, we put something very simple into all of the contracts this year for providers of similar services, but we didn't really define it. Mm-hmm. And I don't really know how we can require people to collaborate when that is, to some extent, it's beyond the scope of the contract. So what would you do?
That's a good question. I think that, you know, keeping open lines of communication between the programs is something that I strive to do right now, and I would absolutely encourage my staff who would be working on this to work very closely with those other programs as they were establishing what their roles in transition would be. So I think it would start there. And I think that having regular meetings, especially when they can be quite planful and looking at sort of what are the different issues that each individual provider is experiencing, you know, and where is their overlap and where is their, you know, where can ideas be shared, and really just, you know, coming together, I think, is often the best place to start when it comes to different agencies working together.
I think all of them are connected to the Transition Planning Committee,
yeah.
So that might be a place to start forming that.
Yeah, absolutely. And we are currently part of the Transition Planning Committee and would absolutely continue to communicate and use that certainly as one additional place to connect with all the stakeholders in the transition realm of things.
I guess just one more little thing.
Sure.
On your community living application,
yeah.
Lynn, again, this I think Lynn made a point about wondering if it would be if you'd be able to track access points for the people involved,
yeah,
and how easy that would be. They would really provide us really good information, I think.
Yeah, you know, I read that and I've been kind of in my head rolling around like what exactly you were wanting, and I think that I would probably need a little bit more clarification as to what you were looking for, but I'm certainly more than happy to talk about what could be done in that in regard or that.
Did you want to talk, Lynn, about what exactly you meant? I took it to mean that it would provide us a really good measure of collaboration, you know.
Like what? So
access points.
This is a little bit different meaning. The access, typically what we're looking for is description of what people can expect at your front door, like how long it will take,
okay.
And who gets, you know, so how much time is a good measure because it's mm-hmm. measurable.
Yeah.
But I think that some of the agencies this year added some language, like how much time it takes really depends on the individual being able to get documentation from their doctor or a school. So it's really difficult for the agencies to commit to time of engagement. But, you know, that's kind of what we're looking for with specific mm-hmm. measures of access. But the other, what I thought you were talking about at first was an idea that I started to discover generally across a lot of applications were that many of the applications involved large parent groups or individuals who are self-advocates, and that those groups might be able to add value to their contract with the DDB by doing something similar but small scale compared to what the RPC is doing with that preference assessment, just kind of giving us a year-end report from their members on what they believe are the gaps in services or gaps where there might be something they'd really enjoy having in the community that doesn't seem available. Mm-hmm. So that's not in any of these, but it was something we talked about too.
So just to make sure I understand, what would be helpful would be kind of an assessment of people who are interested in the community living program and then how many people then access it in the time frame? Okay.
What do people do when they're referred to your agency? What can they expect? You did describe a lot of that. This may be actually one of the applications which said the time of engagement is difficult.
Yeah, well, so in general, right. I will say, so in general, if people express interest in the community living program, they can expect to certainly talk to our community living specialist within probably 2 weeks to just kind of get a better sense of what the program is. So some of that just sort of information sharing at that point, there is some dependency on, you know, making sure we have documentation, which can take a little time. But also then that individual and that family has to decide if that program is right for them. So there's some sort of back and forth in that. Some people are ready to go day one and we're able to start services quite quickly. That program doesn't tend to have a particularly long waiting list, generally not more than one or two people. So we're usually able to begin services quite readily. But I'm certainly happy to look at, you know, what you guys would need for that, should we be funded.
Thank you, Becca.
Absolutely.
DSC.
Hello, Jennifer Carlson. I'm the Director of Residential Services at DSC. The Apartment Services Program is one that you have funded for several years. The program proposes to serve at least 63 people in the next year. The primary services that we provide are to people living in their own home or apartment, and we provide money management and training, independent living skills training, community integration training.
How many people live in the apartments?
CU Independence?
Yeah.
23.
23, okay. And that involves transportation skills, getting to and from, may involve community employment, all of those things.
Correct.
Correctly? Okay. All right. Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you.
I'm Ron Briesco. I'm sorry, I'm fighting a cold and some sinus issues. So, Ron Briesco, Developmental Services Center, and I oversee three programs that you folks fund: clinical, individual and family support, and service coordination. I don't know if you want me to address all three of those at this point. Okay. So, clinical supports. You folks have funded us for several years, and we are able to utilize those funds in supporting our consumers with counseling, psychiatry, and we have a psychologist on contract who does assessments and also helps with some planning for unique situations and individuals. We hope to serve about 70 folks each year, and we usually meet that and exceed it. We, of course, look for other avenues of funding before utilizing your generous funds. But for psychiatry, for instance, wait lists at Carl and other facilities are rather lengthy. And it's kind of a critical issue for our folks to see someone relatively soon. Counseling, we look for Medicaid providers, but there are very few who have experience with individuals with intellectual and developmental disabilities. We do have a number of folks who see counselors who accept Medicaid, and that's great, but that's not always possible. And we are contracting with Linda Leal for psychological support, whether it's evaluations or planning. And she has an incredible amount of experience with individuals with intellectual and developmental disabilities. And her evaluations are very useful for the state. She seems to be in sync with what they're looking for when they provide funding, and what RBC and their assessor looks for in determining eligibility. Any questions on clinical supports? Okay.
So doesn't Linda Liel also do those psychologicals for RPC?
Yes, and I believe other agencies in town.
Is there a reason that we need to do both? Like, is it possible that she could be serving all of the same people that you're referring to her, but doing it through RPC?
I don't know that they necessarily have the funding for that.
But what is the purpose of those psychologicals?
They are usually for determined eligibility.
Okay, but that is a state contract with the RPC, right?
They usually refer them back to us for to get a psychological done.
But I don't know, like in communities where there's not a 377 board, they still get the psychologicals done. So I'm wondering if there's any way to begin shifting that cost burden back to the state.
Well, the majority of individuals who come to DSC requesting services already have some sort of psychological evaluation in schools or through Carl or other facilities. The expense we use for our psychological assessment is the smallest portion, I believe, of the money funds you provide. But if it's a situation where the family has nothing and the individual needs services, then we will go ahead and do that. There's also, you know, families over years receive a ton of paperwork from the schools, and many of the families have young folks with autism or other disabilities, and their hands are kind of full, and their days are long, and sometimes organizing the reams of paperwork they collect over a period of 22 years is challenging. And so we know that some folks have psychologicals, but they can't find them, they can't remember the assessor, and so those are the situations where we often lend support.
But if the only psychological that they have establishing a DD is after the age of 22, can it even help them get eligibility? I mean,
they usually have a school psychological, but often it's not as useful and for identifying specific needs and maybe treatment planning. School psychologicals can be very useful while they're still kids, but when they're adults, they might be older school psychologicals, and as we know, young people change from the age of 15 to 22, and if we want to do a good job, we need to have an accurate picture of that individual. Then we have individual and family support. Individual family support is a program that I really enjoy in that it provides a ton of flexibility and choice to families. There are three segments really to the program. One is we have 8 full-time staff during the day at DSC, and we provide services during the day for individuals who have significant behavioral or medical needs. And these folks usually require one-on-one staff support or possibly one autism and require pretty much one-on-one staff support. The other one of the segments is we provide respite, and that's something that's becoming more and more important as the state eliminates their support for respite for families. And So we can provide anywhere from 3 hours a week or to 10 hours a week. We have some folks who have more than one child with a disability. And the problem we run into with respite is that we have a lack of providers. We have some DSC staff who work as providers. Some families have providers that they find on their own, or a teacher's aide from school who used to know their work with their son or daughter might volunteer and get paid for that. But oftentimes it's really difficult to find a provider for a challenging child. But it is something that families really, really need and appreciate. And the third segment of the program is we assist with camps, funding for camps, equipment that isn't covered by insurance. That's extremely popular over Christmas holiday for schools and spring break. And I'm just starting to get requests for summer. Even though it's a couple months away, families are thinking ahead and asking for support to register their kids in camp, a variety of camps, the USR, Timber Point, and other opportunities for young people and adults. Questions on individual and family support?
Question. Ron, you mentioned that the three main parts of that program. It says in the packet that that's currently running at a deficit. So if this wasn't funded, is there one of those three that's going to go away completely, or you'll lower all three, or you would cover them with other funds?
The segment of the program that provides 8 full-time staff to very, very challenging individuals, families would be at a major loss if they had no place for their young person. They're, most of them are in their 20s to mid-30s, and that would be very difficult. I think there would be families, and I know of some families who were planning for one parent or another to quit their job before we were able to admit them to the program. And I know one was probably, they were going to give 2 weeks' notice, and we finally notified them about 2 days before they gave, one of the parents gave 2 weeks' notice. That would probably be the one that I would like to keep whole. The others, respite, I mean, it would probably be a balance between respite and equipment. Equipment would probably be the first thing that would be curtailed. But the need for respite is also very, very pressing. So I guess I'm saying equipment and camp funding. But camp funding really is respite. I mean, if you have a week where your child, or 5 days where your child goes to Timber Point for overnight, I mean, if that's not respite, what is? So,
Ron, what portion of this application, this grant, do you think goes toward supporting the individuals with the challenging behaviors in their 20s to 30s, the piece that you would keep if you could only keep one piece?
Oh, geez, probably. Quick math in my head. Probably 75% of it. I mean, that's just quick math in my head. Okay. In the last... In the last program I oversee is service coordination, and we serve on a yearly basis, you know, 290 to 320 people. It varies as people leave the community or unfortunately pass away. It's a program that is kind of a catch-all. We do coordination in-house for planning and coordinating the interdisciplinary team. We're the keeper of the files, both paper and computer. And with that number of individuals being served, there are, each individual has to have one annual meeting, plus as things occur throughout the year, if an individual decides either by voicing a need for a change in his or her plan or by their participation or behavior, they're telling us they need a change, then we get together and have another meeting, which is called a case conference. And we might, for some individuals, we might have several case conferences a year to try to get the interdisciplinary team back together and find another way. I mean, we always think there is a way to serve a person regardless of their behaviors or other needs, and we just need to find the right way, and sometimes that requires several meetings throughout the year. The other aspect of the program is kind of external in that we coordinate their Social Security, their Medicaid. We have access to housing vouchers, and then we work with the housing authority to also try to find ways for individuals to live in apartments in this community, which is very expensive, and so not very many of our clients can really afford housing in this expensive market. That's just a small amount. I mean, you know, there's anything from our folks are like everyone else. They might have other issues, legal issues, guardianship issues. We have had some contact with law enforcement, and so we help individuals through those. Just anything that any of us can get involved in, they can get involved in. Marriage, you name it. Kids.
I don't have a question again, but it is a comment. One of the things that I hear you talking about is serving people with pretty difficult situations. We've been asked for a lot of money for transitional from high school into other programs. But sometimes I worry that we are beginning to think that people who must have, I'm talking about families, I'm talking about individuals who must have pretty intensive help, let's just put it that way. We have to keep in mind that these folks are still here and they need those things. Psychologicals are important. A psychologist is important. Psychiatry is important. Respite is important. I mean, we're looking at things that, you know, over the years you have developed to help people like this. The new money that came in, obviously we want to help everybody we can help. But that includes people who need to transition from high school into living supports. I think that we need to be very careful that we fund people who have intensive. We also need to remember that we need to also cover people who have serious disabilities. And when I hear you talk about them and what would you have to let go, I don't know how we can let go of those things.
I really don't know how you do without respite or
I don't either.
A place for some of these young people to spend their time during the day.
Exactly.
Who have such significant needs, both medical and behavioral.
And we're looking, that's what I'm talking about. Yeah. The medical needs of some of these folks are really very, very important and time-consuming, staff-consuming. Mm-hmm. All of those things are there, and we don't really hear much about those folks anymore. We hear a lot more about people coming out of the school districts who need transitional support. I don't know what the answer is. I know we have to be fair about all of this, but to take any money away from people who have families that just are going to collapse without this help, we have to be very careful about that funding. Just a comment.
I agree, and it happens to be the segment of the population we serve that I most enjoy. I really do, and it's just because of the need. And the families are fantastic, and they do incredible work with their young people, but they need some help.
Ron, I'm curious about medical home. The range of programs you've talked about, I assume one of those is assisting or making sure that the individual is connected, has a medical home established, and mm-hmm. a primary care provider.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see how that works. I've been to some trainings throughout the state. When I see and hear about the outline of the medical homes, but at this point,
I guess I'm just want to be sure that as part of the work you're doing, that one of the services you're providing is making sure that this person has an established primary care provider. And
the majority, they pretty much have to. I mean, their needs, and that kind of covers the full range of higher skilled folks and the individuals I've been talking about. They, with especially more significant disabilities, they tend to have more significant medical needs, and sometimes their behavioral needs arise from hidden medical issues, whether that's dental or other issues. It's one of the first things we have the family with us check out, is that something's wrong, and if they're nonverbal, we can't tell what's going on. The first thing we check is medical. But that's something that's fairly consistent throughout all of our consumers, that they have primary care physicians, and it's not something we have to assist getting them there often, and sometimes we have to help support the family to move an appointment up or getting certain labs done. But I don't know of many families at all that don't have a primary care physician. Psychiatry is a whole different story. I mean,
I think that's a big conversation that we've had before and that we have often. But when you, so I'm just going to, I want to ask a question related to Joyce's comments. Is it your experience that people in transition have much less intensive needs than the people you're serving already? Are you finding a much lower need for services?
Not necessarily at all in transition. I mean, there are some, we have a number of folks on our waiting list for IFS who hear about our program through teachers in the community or other parents that, you know, they have a very challenging son or daughter with either medical or behavioral needs. And they'll say, well, they'll actually name a kid who's in our program. We want Jimmy's program, and they don't know what the real name of the program is, but they know what they want, and it's the more intensive.
So to connect that to Mark's comment then, for people who are younger and to serve them means you would stop being able to serve an older person with more intensive needs who's already seeing your psychiatrist, there is usually capacity, there's available capacity at the FQHC. But the trick is that a person has to be willing to take their primary care there as well. So when you're beginning to see people with those more intensive needs who might fit well into the medical home, we could start to one of the barriers that you've always had is that providers are not able to deal with developmental disabilities for some reason. There's no, you know, medical school tends to skip over specific instruction related to working with people with DDs, and that's, you know, while that's being corrected for the future, for now, there could be opportunities to get those people plugged into services other than those funded through the clinical contract or service coordination by setting them up at the FQHC where they can function as a health home.
And we have, our case coordinators have started to refer people over there over the past year or six, 8 months. For families that specifically served in IFS, some of the difficulty attending a medical appointment for that individual or being touched can be a major issue. And so if they have a family doctor who this young person has seen for years and years, that relationship is critical to getting to managing behavior in the medical appointment. We also have that difficulty in the emergency room. I mean, there are some folks who do not want to be touched, and we need to have staff there to comfort them well. Yeah.
Going back to leveraging resources, for the individuals who are served through the service coordination grant, can you tell me how many of them have a Medicaid waiver or a ballpark estimate percentage?
Possibly a third. The issue there is some have a waiver that provides for developmental training, which is a pretty kind of concentrated Medicaid waiver. It doesn't fund case coordination or service coordination, as opposed to maybe a person who lives in a group home or CILA. There's a portion of their work. The same thing goes for regular work or supported employment. I mean, it's just for the actual work program. It's not for any other related services.
I think you're done, Ron.
Thank you.
Get some rest.
Yeah.
Hello, Annette Becker, Director of Employment Services for DSC. I'm going to knock off several here. And if it works for you all, I'd like to kind of talk about them collectively because they're all very interrelated. So I'll talk about community employment, connections, employment first, and then also our integrated and we're calling it community first applications as well. Actually, all of these programs have been funded in the past. The Connections is new, but, you know, all of these were kind of born out of our desire as a county to really embrace community first and for our community to be a leader in that. And it was a collaborative effort between several service providers. And when I go back and review those documents that we developed several years ago, I'm really heartened to see how really on target we were and how far we've come. So, you know, the goal is employment is the first and the foremost goal, and we know that that's going to take some time for everybody to transition away from in-center services to more community-based services. And so what we're doing is kind of this continuum of services. So the integrated or community first services, that's really about the people who are in our sheltered workshop and are working toward building community connections, building on work skills through volunteer opportunities, and just looking outside of DSC as their primary Monday through Friday, you know, eight to four or nine to three, whatever. And so while that's going on, we're also looking at how can we help people find employment that might be outside of the traditional employment. And so we have, for our Connections program, we are hoping to work with individuals who want to look at self-employment. Our first group is the Enactus group, and they actually did some test runs yesterday for their T-shirt business. And so in addition to that group, we want to help other people also in their self-employment efforts, as well as provide some avenues for artistic expression. And then our community employment is more along the lines of our of the traditional employment. And one of the pieces that we've added to that is a supported employment specialist who will help find enclaves. So there would be actually a supervisor working with two or three or four individuals in a community job. And again, as part of the continuum of people experiencing employment outside of the sheltered workshop setting. Again, for community employment, we're helping people one person at a time find employment, making sure it's a job based on their areas of interest, their ability levels, good natural supports, and then providing ongoing job coaching and fading that support back. And then the final piece to that is the employment first, and that is the outreach to employers and the business community. If we don't have the business community on board, then we could have 50 job developers out there looking for jobs, and if nobody's hiring or nobody sees the benefits of hiring people with disabilities, you know, our efforts are going to be in vain. That's the application in conjunction with community choices. I think that's it. I don't know if you have any questions. I'm sorry, also with the employment first, it's the involvement of working with families and individuals who are used to the traditional services and helping them in the transition away from the traditional services as well.
And I've asked this question from presenters and things like that, but just if you have community employment, typically it's not going to be a complete day somewhere. And for many people that are in, as we call them, sheltered workshops, many of them have been there for years, and they have social connections with the people that are there. I'm just interested in what kind of planning is being done for people that do go out into community employment, want to go out into community employment, but can only get 2 to 3 hours a day of work. What kind of planning are we thinking about doing for folks who really, I mean, that's all of us, you know, even adults that are completely able, having a part-time job is difficult. So is there any kind of planning that's going into what will happen with these folks who do move into the community? And I'm using this example only because I'm familiar with it. It's the only one I'm familiar with. My son worked at Sam's Club for 15 years as a person who brought carts in from the lot. The people that he made connections with there were very important in his life. There's no doubt about that. They were very good with him. The staff that worked with him from his job coaching on was also excellent. However, he is now working in Clark Road, and his work is all day, and he has as normal a life as possible doing that, has social connections there now. So my question is, are we going to move people out into community employment part-time? Do you have any inkling of how that's going to work for people that have been in those situations? He's 43.
Mm-hmm.
How is that planning taking place. It isn't, I know employment first is a great thing. I'm not saying anything against that. I'm just saying, what do we do with folks that are working 2 to 3 hours a day and then they have the rest of the day?
You know, I think that's one of the benefits we've seen of people participating in the groups that we're doing from our within our integrated Community First program. The social connect, you know, a lot of times people are really good workers, but they don't have those social connections right. with people. And what we're trying to do is, you know, if you only eat vanilla ice cream, how do you know you don't like pistachio unless you try it?
Yeah.
So, you know, so we're trying to help people step outside and to see that part of your life is work and part of it is those social connections. You know, I think a lot of times we've done a really good job of helping people look to us for setting those things up for them. So just working with people on, you want to do this with two of your friends, well, how do you make that happen? How do you call them? What time do you want to meet? Who do you, you know, where do you want to go? Do you have the money to do it? Where do you find out what's going on in town? And an example that happened just earlier this week, one individual is participating in one of the volunteer groups, and he enjoyed it so much, he actually approached the business. It was Salt and Light. He went to the manager and asked if he could come a day on his own and volunteer on his own. He's going to get there on the bus. We helped him, you know, fill out the application. But he initiated that on his own.
Right.
You know, some people will continue to, you know, come to Clark Road or McKinley for whatever part-time. I think, it's the transition. As the younger kids are transitioning from high school, they've had more of the community experiences and opportunities. So maybe coming to DSC is part of their day or a few days per week, but then they're making connections with the park district or other places so that one support system isn't their be-all to end-all, but they really have kind of diversity in where they find their supports.
Okay. Well,
did
thanks.
That answer your question?
Yeah.
Okay.
Thanks.
The billion, trillion-dollar
question. Yeah. You know, and what we found is that, you know, a lot of people who are moving from our in-house programs to the community for employment, they don't want to work all the time in the community initially, but we find that over time, they're willing to gradually increase that time in the community for employment. But it is important for us to be able to help them make those social connections because sometimes they do want to just be there for their friends. Thank you.
Saving the best of DSC for last. Right? I'm Felicia Guler, and I'm the director of the Family Development Center, which is our children's program. We provide community and home-based therapy services for young children with disabilities or at risk with disabilities through developmental screening, which we really consider an important component of what we do out there screening children and to find and provide intervention as early as possible if there are issues or problems with them. And then we provide developmental therapy, speech therapy, the play project. We maximize state funds as much as possible for children who qualify under the state funded EI program, which is children who have a 30% delay or more in one or more area of development. And then we also provide the Play Project, which is a specialized program for young children with autism. And again, for children under three, we look to the state to help support that. And then for children over three, DDB funds provide that service.
Okay.
Do you have questions about this program that's been around for a very, very, very long time? The state is not, you know, not in good shape right now as far as EI services, 90 days delayed in payments, lack of service providers are getting worse. Some physicians in the area will not even use EI anymore. They go right to services through insurance and kind of in-house in hospital just because their kids aren't getting the services. So no questions? Okay.
Thank you, Felicia.
We were just commenting about, I had sort of forgotten that we think the consent decree is protecting DD services, but it wouldn't be protecting EI services.
Hello.
Hello. Vicki Nicewander from the Illinois Association of Microboards and Cooperatives. This is our second request for funds from the DD board. The first year is, just as a reminder, focused on building teams for individuals, and our commitment was to start 10 teams this first year. We actually have created 12 and are supporting the development of teams for those 12 individuals, focused on exactly what, Joyce, you were bringing up with employment earlier. It's about a whole life, and so this is a very holistic approach where we bring people together who care about the individual and who work together to create that life that is meaningful for them. And so it starts with a person-centered plan, and we meet monthly to follow up, develop, and keep on working on that person-centered plan until we really have ultimately developed some great programs and opportunities for that person in their community. So it's very different based on each person, but our commitment is to, in the second year of the grant, to help those original teams to become more independent and able to facilitate their own meetings with a little bit of assistance from us, and bringing teams together so that they can support each other. We have very unique individuals with unique needs, but wherever possible to bring them together to share their supports and ideas. And we have our first opportunity within this grant year to do that in May. We're bringing David Wetherill, who was our consultant from Vancouver. He's going to be doing a presentation right here in this room on May 5th, but on the night before, on May 4th, we're going to be bringing together as many of our teams as possible to talk about what their successes have been, what challenges they've had, sharing their ideas and resources, and we are really very excited about this as an opportunity. In the second year of the grant, we hope to do that on a quarterly basis with the teams. And by the way, when we bring people together on the 4th, we actually have several individuals who plan to attend who are thinking about creating teams for the next year. But the examples that we can give about how people have in several cases created something from nothing. We have people who have no services whatsoever and have really used the people to think about those connections. Another thing that we have added to the grant for next people who are facilitators of person-centered planning that we can utilize for our teams. We have some interest from the people who are on the teams to become facilitators as a result of their experiences. With that, I guess, the other piece I didn't mention in the new proposal is that we're going to start building a leadership team of community members, some who have had experiences with our existing teams and other connections that we know of in the community who might be able to provide some input, feedback, and some other connections for people who are
who are living the team model right now. So somebody who is struggling with a particular thing might be able to come to that leadership team and present what they're doing and get some feedback from those folks on how they might proceed and other ideas that those people might have to improve that team situation. There was a question asked about the research by the reviewer, and I was starting to put together a list, and there was so much that I really couldn't, but just to summarize, a lot of what we do comes from the research that's been decades old of inclusive education. It's kind of an extension of inclusive education and looking at real community experiences as opposed to separate isolated ones, which the state of Illinois obviously has become, and nationally has been very dependent on for years, including institutions and that kind of thing. A part of our research also comes from the wraparound research from the 1980s, starting in the 80s. That started out being a very community-based team-building model as we are using, and has since developed into kind of a provider model. And so we're trying to get back to the community part of this, because obviously lots of providers can't afford to come together to support individuals on a regular basis like that. And then third, our person-centered planning has been in research for many, many years, and we continue to develop that and put a great deal of focus on person-centered planning as well. Questions?
I have one. Without violating confidentiality or anything, can you give me some information about how the teams that you've developed have impacted the individuals in quality of life ways?
Well, I can tell you without risking, divulging the person, how about if I use my daughter as an example? My daughter lived with us until she was 31 years old. And for the last, because of her micro board and the difference between a team and a micro board is incorporated. So she does have a group that has met on her behalf for a number of years. She lives in her own home, supported by a person who lives near her. She has a job working about 15 hours a week as an assistant teacher for a local daycare. Now that was thanks to her the job negotiation. She was the first person placed in a job by Community Choices about 7 years ago. And so that continues. She's able to walk to work from her home. She volunteers at the local elementary school. She volunteers at the Humane Society. She volunteers at the library. She volunteers at her church. She also attends a community choir that meets every Monday night. She's the only person in the choir who has a disability. The choir director has been to some of her micro board meetings and has been a great resource to her. We continue to invite people from all areas of her life. An employer comes one time, somebody from one of her volunteer experiences comes another time, and that continues to develop as time goes on. She also works out 3 days a week at a local gym. She has a book club every Wednesday night with her friends. I know I'm leaving stuff out, but she has a very, very full life, and it is because we continue to look at, what is it that she's doing? How can we continue to make that better for her? Most of our teams are much more at the beginning step of this process, but the people who have been doing this model for a long time have found it to be a life-changing way of engaging community and engaging the individual in doing the things that they love to do.
Vicki, so you're requesting about $65,000.
Mm-hmm.
And if I'm reading this right, about 70-some percent of that goes to personnel costs.
Right.
And of that, it's really just two people. Is that right?
Right.
So what... That's the bottom line, I guess, to try to explain what the personnel costs, what do those two people do? Is it the initial setup? Is it maintenance of the microboards? Is it facilitating? What did those two people do for the 60-some thousand?
It is pretty much facilitation of teams, and right now we have our 12 teams that we're working on a regular basis with to, you know, get them established. And so part of it is training, part of it is just meeting facilitation, throwing out ideas, you know, how can we expand this model? We've put together an agenda that is very friendly for teams that are not professionally based to do this on their own. So ultimately, we'd like to see the reins taken over by the teams who are existing and finding success and able to manage this team process on their own so that we can move on to do others. So really, it's our facilitation of this grant and making sure that people, you know, that they keep going, that they're not only experiencing their successes, but building on those.
So you're investing time to get this set up, and then after how long do you drop out of that so there's no more labor expended on those established micro boards? Is it 2 years, and then they're on their own, and you're weaned off of it, or how's that work?
Well, it depends, and that's my answer to many questions, because it depends on the individual. It depends on what kind of support they have. It depends on on the willingness of the family to bring in other people to help make those decisions. And so generally, if the group becomes a micro board, then they are established at that point and able to probably maintain on their own. We actually have one micro board that's at the statewide SILA training today. They are very much intending to become a SILA provider for their daughter down the road. And so we do have those very strong teams who are willing to take a step out, and we have several teams who have really only met two or three times at this point. So I would say that there are probably about half of our teams that are ready to take on some more responsibility at this point, more by the end of this fiscal year, I'm sure. And we intend to use those teams as resources to help support some of the newer teams. But our role is in this, you know, organizing, collaborating with all of the groups and making sure that all of that information is shared.
I have a question. The numbers show 16 having been served, 12 are active. So that does that mean, and following up with David's question, Mr. Happ's question, that four have moved to self-sufficiency then and don't?
No, four started out with us and had initial meetings and then decided that they were really too busy at this point to engage. A couple of them are ones who are coming back to us in the May meeting so that they can get involved again. And a couple of people just said, you know, we just don't have the ability at this time to spend time doing this.
Okay. And then in terms of next year, you expect to continue to provide support to a fair number of the teams that have been formed now. How many new folks do you expect to take on in the coming year?
Well, we've committed to 10 us to do that.
Okay. In terms of your target, you might want to look at adjusting that to reflect the folks you're going to continue to work with.
Mm-hmm.
Because right now it looks like you're just going to be reporting on the 10 new ones, but you will have the opportunity for the second year to report on those that you continue to provide support to.
Okay, great.
You might as well take credit for the work you're doing.
May as well, absolutely. And just as an aside, we did get funding through Champaign County, Illinois Council on Developmental Disabilities to replicate this project in Geneseo, Illinois. And so we're going to be working on the other side of Illinois to establish staff and have a group over there that's really excited about the opportunity to do this. Anything else?
Thank you, Vicki.
Okay.
Okay, next is PACE.
Hello. I'm Jermaine Raymer. I'm the program director at PACE Center for Independent Living. This is Dylan. He's the Opportunities for Independence coordinator. So he oversees the program, which is funded by the DDB. Basically, there are two primary components of this year's application. The first is kind of the component we've been doing basically since you guys started funding our program, which is providing both individualized and group independent living skills trainings, employment training, basically focusing on developing those job readiness skills in the employment areas and developing whatever skills are needed to live independently and basically to gain or build and even just maintain and expand your independence. So, and then the second primary part of the application this year is going into schools. And we've made inroads into primarily three rural schools within Champaign County this year to provide independent living philosophy focused trainings with topics from independent living to advocacy, really focused to try to ensure that students are able to gain those skills at an earlier point rather than after they enter the community.
And if I may. I would like to provide you a quick update on our numbers for the first three quarters.
You provide us with numbers for the first and third quarters?
First three quarters.
First three quarters, okay.
I know the if you just look at the report that we have, it doesn't show a lot of work, and that is because I had some major health issues in the first and second quarter.
He had said that he wanted to give you an update on why the numbers were so low in the first and second quarters because he had some health issues during that time period.
So after the third quarter, our year $2 for 2023 is 24.
Year-to-date total after third quarters for TPC is 24.
For NTPC, it's 22.
NPTC is 22.
There's hours. I... 367.
Service hours are 367?
0.75.
0.75.
Which I estimate there to be about 185 service contacts.
Which I estimate to be 185 service contacts.
I also have 23 community service events.
I also have 23 community service events.
So. We had a very strong third quarter, and I expect that to continue for the fourth quarter.
We had a strong third quarter, and I expect that to continue for the fourth.
So I expect to contribute all of my benchmarks.
So I expect to meet all my benchmarks.
Is the happy third quarter and that work continues. I think we, as always, whenever we're talking about transition services, we have those two big questions, which are how to coordinate with other providers of similar services, and then the other one, which we've sort of been touching on all afternoon, is how is this not presenting us with a statutory conflict? If the schools are responsible for some of these services, and if they are providing some of the services, then the statute prohibits the use of these funds for anything that's covered in the school code. So we have to be really careful with what the service activity is. And that applies for all of the programs that we've talked about today, which have a presence in the schools or propose to.
Right, and we, to address that, we don't see a conflict with the 377 funds due to the fact that these are trainings based on independent living philosophy and history, which are not necessarily trainings the schools have been doing or maybe even are equipped to do due to their experience and due to their experience and kind of their course progressions.
Is it their responsibility under the law?
I think that's unclear. In terms of that specific context, I don't believe so. In that context, I don't necessarily believe so.
Lynn, we can publish the Article 14 again. We occasionally put that in the board packet so that everyone can see what it means, what the services are that are covered under the school code. It's Article 14. It's available online, though.
Right.
So.
Lynn, I think you mentioned in the when you were reviewing these summaries, you used the word supplanting the curriculum.
Right.
And in this case, I think they're talking about augmenting the mm-hmm. curriculum, right? There's nothing removed from the school curriculum. You're adding something.
Yes, we are adding to
and
the school.
Is there a difference?
I think that is a very important.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
The supplanting is in our funding guidelines anyway for, you know, supplanting anything that the state should be doing, but the specific restriction to the 377 is a little bit, it's a little bit higher bar. It's about not funding anything that's covered under Article 14, whether it's performed or not. And so when we've spent a whole year talking a lot about the importance. We've talked a lot about the importance of improving. And some people in the room here have spent a lot of time.
I think it's Lynn.
I think it's just, it's really nice that so many of the applications responded to that active discussion that we've been engaged in for a year in this meeting and then outside of this meeting, and that many of you have spent a lot of time and energy on. But we still have that caution we have to be really aware of. So I think if the board decides to fund some of these programs, we do need to specifically address through the contract those two things, coordinating with other providers of similar services and avoiding anything that would be a violation of the statute. So, sorry. I better stop talking.
Thank you, Dylan and Jermaine. Next up, Rosecrans.
Hi, good afternoon. Ours is still working so far. I'm Julie Cartel. I'm the Director of Clinical Services at Rosecrans, and this is Kathy Kessler, who is the supervisor of the person in the program for the program we've applied here for. And I'll let Kathy just give you a brief overview of the program.
Our program is the coordination of services for the developmentally disabled and mentally ill. This program, this position was developed probably 4 or 5 years ago. And it was developed specifically because agencies in the community felt like there was a gap in services of individuals that had a developmental disability and also a mental illness. So this program has kind of filled that gap that many of the providers had acknowledged. Okay, the position basically works in identifying cases of clients that have a mental illness and have a developmental disability. They do screenings of these individuals. They meet with service providers in coordinating on the cases and collaborating on the cases in order to get the best services that are needed for that individual. We coordinate a lot with DSC, community connection in their homes, be it in the community, be at work sites, to wherever, you know, it's most comfortable for them. She sees the individuals on a regular basis, generally anywhere from weekly to every 2 weeks. She is also involved in some other activities. She's involved in speaking engagements. She's involved with the disability fair, those kind of additional things that she does through the grant. Do you have any questions?
How do you see this? Do you see this as being successful for people that have the dual diagnosis?
Yes, I really do, and I see the program as growing because if we look at the numbers have increased over the years of the referrals that we're getting, and a lot of times some of the other agencies, they're working on, I mean, and we really clearly define the roles, you know, like maybe, you know, maybe DFC is providing the case management services and the rep payee services, whereas we would be more focused on working with the clients on their skill building. You know, maybe they're having difficulty communicating with different people. They're having, maybe because of their symptoms, they're acting out. The case manager really does a lot of problem solving and a lot of, you know, skill building with the clients in working on developing their skills so that they don't have maybe as many outbursts or things like that.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Next, Rural Champaign County Special Education Co-op.
Good afternoon. So I'm Jim Mayer, and this is Barb Bressner. And as many of you know, Barb and I have been involved for a number of years in helping coordinate the Disability Resource Expo. And I first of all want to acknowledge I'm employed by the Rural Champaign County Special Ed Cooperative. And then Barb, as most of you know, has been a consultant with coordinating the expo for a number of years. First of all, I wanted to say our executive director, Jennifer Armstrong, wanted to give her regrets. She couldn't be here today, so I'm here representing our agency. And since, you know, I know some of you have been involved in this board since the inception of the expo, and others maybe have come you know, involved more recently. So I'll give a little history, quick history leading us up to this moment, why we're, you know, why this proposal's on the table. We've celebrated our 10th annual expo this past fall. You know, this was, again, you know, an event created obviously by this board and also the Mental Health Board in conjunction, and, you know, created a halftime position, basically approximately a halftime position for Barb to coordinate that event. And then about, what, 4 years ago maybe, something like that, Barb saw two things happening. She saw that she wanted a little more help with that position of hers, and also she saw I was putting in quite a bit of time outside my regular job helping coordinate that, so she offered sort of a job share with that position. I took over approximately a quarter of her halftime position for the past 4 years, you know, involved, again, through the two boards. So I noticed this year that both boards had put out a desire to no longer serve as the fiscal agent for this event, since you don't serve as a fiscal agent really for anything, you know, as far as direct fiscal agency. And, you know, it occurred to me that my agency is pretty well equipped to do something like that in terms of the infrastructure we have and bookkeeping and so forth. And because the event is something near and dear to my heart and something that serves, you know, our families as well as many others in our community, that our agency might make sense as, you know, as a fiscal agent for this event. And so I approached our director and our boards about doing that, and they were, you know, supportive. And so I built a proposal based really on last year's budget, and also on what seemed, you know, reasonable in this kind of a transition for our agency to try to take this on. And so let me just talk about the budget a little bit. You know, last year's budget was for $61,100 was last year's budget figure I had from a budget made up by Nancy Crawford of the two boards who had served, you know, as the bookkeeper for the event over the years. And this budget, you'll notice, is a little higher. It's $76,700, with $10,000 of that coming from booth fees, ads, and sponsorships. Now, that is a very conservative estimate. So one thing I want to address right off the bat, I noticed under the grant requirements of the two boards that funds in excess of what's reimbursable are subject to recovery. And I will say, you know, if this next year plays out similarly to previous years, the amount from ads and booth fees will be considerably higher than $10,000. Last year's budget had estimated $16,000 for that, and I think we came in pretty close to that. The one thing that I've eliminated from the budget in terms of income that was there before was fundraisers. We were at about $4,000. estimated last year in fundraising, and I did not think that was a reasonable thing to ask of our board to take on the risk, you know, of monitoring a budget that relied on too much fundraising. But nevertheless, you know, what we find is a number of our vendors have chosen to pay more than simply their standard booth fees and have, you know, taken on sponsorships of even up to $1,000 per an agency in the past, which, you know, I anticipate that will still continue. We'll still offer ads in the booklet for that additional sort of sponsorship that those organizations might do. And so I would, you know, I can't guarantee, but I would foresee and predict that a fair amount of this $76,000 budget would be reimbursed to the two boards by whatever mechanisms, you know, that you have set up for that. Yeah, I saw that written in the instructions for setting up a grant, and so that I wanted to just cover that right off the bat. I also wanted to say that I know that your boards, everything else that you fund is on a county and state fiscal year, a July 1 fiscal year. This event up till now had been on a calendar fiscal year, and I'm assuming the boards did that because it was a fall event, and that was near the end of the calendar year. So for that reason and others.
It's because the boards are on a calendar fiscal year.
Oh.
Yes.
Oh, I didn't realize that. So anyway, but all of your other contracts are on the county fiscal year, correct? The July 1?
No. It's all of the agency contracts are on a fiscal year that is similar to it's the same as the state's fiscal
right.
year, and that's because almost all of them have state funding.
Right.
So our July fiscal 1. Year is calendar year, and so just one of these are kind of advantages that may seem small, but to me, it's a big deal that you could advance pay across a fiscal year, and we can't. Mm-hmm. So we can't pay for things in November that you're going to do in April.
Ah, okay.
But you could do that through your organization.
Right. Our organization is set up on the state fiscal year, July 1 fiscal year. And so this would fit nicely within our current, you know, financial operations. And also, you know, going along with this, I think you've all been made aware by some of our Save the Dates and so forth. You know, Barb and I have met with our steering committee and discussed moving this to a spring event starting next year so that it fits more nicely into a state fiscal year and also in a school year, as far as there will be, I think, some promotional at the 15th of August, which has been a tight timeline. And there's also a lot of things going on in the fall, obviously with football games and all those things we've had to avoid in the past. Spring has a little more leeway that way. And so that's another part of this proposal, is shifting to a July 1 fiscal year and a springtime expo starting next school year. And so April 7th is the date that's been established, and we have found a new venue. As you probably have heard as well, our venue we've been using the last several years is no longer open to this type of event. Fluid events is no longer in existence as it was. So we have a tentative arrangement with the Vineyard Church in Urbana to host our event. We've, you know, shopped around and explored and measured and also, you know, and found a good pricing there, as well as nice space for the event. You know, very up-to-date, accessible space with nice restrooms, and also really just sort of a friendly environment to outside, you know, use like this. It turns out they host the police academy graduations and a number of other kind of general community things. So we have secured a venue in the Vineyard. A couple of other things I just wanted to address, kind of in response to some of the reviewers' questions on this. There was a question about, you know, whether we evaluate the event, and I apologize, I didn't really have that in the body of the main proposal, but it is in the cultural competence plan that we do participant satisfaction surveys every year. That's been a big part of the expo, and it's a part of our evaluation report that we do with our steering committee. We also put out surveys to all of our exhibitors and get, you know, garner their input for our future planning and bring that back to our committee as well. And I want to also just emphasize, you know, this budget number may seem high to the casual observer here for, you know, they'll say, well, is this just for an expo? Really, it's for more than an expo. It's for a year-round, a broad-based effort that involves many of the people seated in this audience on committees and subcommittees, and it's become, I think, a focal point for our community and one that really highlights disability issues and sort of the value of people with disabilities among us. And So, and that would continue, and as well, I saw this as an opportunity to insert something that would sort of add value to the event, which is, you know, we have a booklet, a resource booklet every year that we print for the event that's then available throughout the year that has all of our exhibitors listed from that year. But it occurred to us that now that the help book is no longer available in our community, that a resource would be helpful that on our website that would include not only this current year's exhibitors, but past exhibitors who maybe didn't make it this year, but who are important, and also future possible exhibitors that we're trying to groom who we think are important resources for our community. So as we speak, you know, Barb and I have already come up with about approximately 40, agencies to add to our list of about 100 that are on the directory right now on the website. And we also are working on making the website more user-friendly in terms of, you know, having things listed under category of service, and then also we hope to add a search feature. And we've been meeting with Chandra and Lynn as well to talk about that and make it a, you know, we hope will be a very broad-based resource for our community in terms of a website. So
I think we would propose to do that sooner than later, and to do it outside of your budget, to do it with our administrative budget, because it's a service to the whole community.
Mm-hmm.
And then, so the work that you're doing on expanding the resource directory, you would still do on the Expo site, but that we would keep working together on this other project to make mm-hmm. it searchable and comprehensive. And we also, I just bought the domain name for it so that you can have both
mm-hmm.
the Expo and this, just the focus on a resource directory, because you are absolutely right. We keep hearing about that from a lot of different sources that this is a needed
piece. People need a user-friendly, like somebody new to the area, or even if they're not new to the area, if they're transitioning out of high school and they've had all these services wrapped around them in the school, but now, you know, as you all know, the adult service network is a much broader and more difficult thing to understand. So so we think that could be a very valuable thing. And a question also that came from the reviewer is, you know, why is there not a line item in the budget for that? It's because the county has already purchased a GoDaddy site for several years. I think now it's paid for, right? It's, I think, paid up for the next several years. So we're just looking at expanding that current GoDaddy site that we have for the Disability Resource Expo. And this wouldn't supplant, you know, there's still, we have it in the budget to print a booklet. We think it's still important to have a booklet, a guide at each expo, but we'd have this online resource that's a broader booklet or broader, you know, directory. I'm trying to think if there were other issues from the proposal that I wanted to address.
On the website too, we would have the ability to link to a lot of these organizations that we, you know, that are at the expo that are, you know, a part of our group. So that would be.
Yeah, so if you're reading up on one of the organizations that's here, let's say DSC, we hope to just have that automatic link to the DSC website as a feature of that. One of the other things that had come up from the reviewer's comments, the staff comment had said that, you know, beyond the event itself, which, you know, serves approximately 2,000 people, we currently track the attendance at our various subcommittee meetings. We could easily include that in our report to the boards, that's, you know, in a way that those are events, we have, for instance, an exhibitor meet and greet coming up May 4th at the new venue. We have Senator Frerichs coming to talk about the ABLE accounts. And also, we just want to get our exhibitors excited about a spring event and to see the new venue. So that's something where we can track attendance. That's an event that's affiliated also with the expo. So we can easily add those numbers to our report, because it really does involve a lot of meetings and a lot of people, very broad-based, as you know, a very broad-based effort. So, and then getting back to the budget, just to give you some quick, the main other difference in the budget that makes for a higher amount than what you were accustomed to, higher than the $61,000, is approximately 16% of the $76,000 budget was for the administration, you know, fees that have been added in for my agency to be the fiscal agent, you know, to cover our bookkeeper time, our administrator time, our auditor time. There's a little bit in there for occupancy, just to make that sort of reasonable. And, you know, I had to present this to our board of superintendents in a way that would appear reasonable to them, where it's not a huge risk or, you know, a huge expense to them. They're certainly incurring some of the costs here of doing this. But now, other than that, the numbers are pretty much based on last year's budget. I think I've addressed most of the other thoughts I wanted to. Barb, is there anything else you want to mention?
No, I think, you know, basically this has been a very successful event. It has been the largest anti-stigma event that we have in this, you know, community, this county. We have expanded to kind of East Central Illinois, so it is broader than it used to be. And so I, you know, we are seeing it used. We, you know, I get calls periodically. Jim gets calls. The resource books are being used. We witnessed that the other night when I was at a meeting with CTF and you know, they had Scott Bennett there, and there was a family there. You know, I don't know where, you know, what's going on in this community. We need resources. They had a book. They handed it to him. It was just, yeah. So, yeah.
So any questions?
No questions. Just keep going.
Thanks. Anybody else? Questions? No? Okay. Thank you much.
Thank you. And last but not least, UCP.
Amount this year due to continuing fibrosis and then that chief appointment of the services officer not meeting the eligibility requirements of the program. And so our numbers aren't meeting the projected numbers that we've projected in the past. So the program, again, it is the same program. It provides vocational and job support services to individuals with disabilities in the form of extended job coaching and case management services, as well as vocational training, so that individuals can obtain and maintain successful employment in the community. Any questions?
Since the application was submitted, did your staff go through the customized employment training?
Is yes, that... two of them did.
Three.
Oh, three of them did. Three, yeah.
There's a companion proposal before the Mental Health Board to fund the services for folks that do not qualify for this specific program.
Correct. Okay. Because most of the referrals that we are getting have a behavioral and or mental health diagnosis, and so that's where we're seeing those referrals coming in, and they don't meet the DD requirement of this program.
So you based the split on your actual numbers?
Yes.
Okay. And are some of those people that you're keeping for long-term support after they finish a DORS contract?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. And just, I think there was one other question about the cultural competency plan. We did not have our FY18 one done in February, so because our admin committee meets in April, and so they did last week, and we have our new FY18 done. So we have that one. So,
Thank you.
Thanks.
On the note of cultural competency, Chandra, did you have any information that you wanted to share specifically about any or all of the plans for this year? And then I also would invite the board if anybody has questions about the plans.
One of the things that I noticed going through the plans this year, this is my first full year being with the board, I was noticing that there was not progress made from year to year, and that individuals were submitting the same plan from the previous year, which, even though your board may not have done it, is fine, and you have the opportunity. But I went back and reviewed the quarterly reports and noticed that they were not making the progress, even within the quarterly reports. So this year, I'm going to do a lot more monitoring to see if they're actually accomplishing what they're actually saying that is happening, and make sure that I report that. Because it was very clear that it was the same thing. And there were a few that I noted it on that I noticed that there was no progress made from the previous year. Example, simple. CLC training would be conducted annually. It's not being conducted annually. This is simple. And groups are saying that they will do it annually. But then when I went back and looked at the quarterly reports and the end of the year reports, it wasn't showing that it had been completed.
And was it your impression that they just weren't updating their notes, or they really just weren't doing the trainings?
I don't want to assume. I just know what I just wrote. What they wrote.
What we've talked about internally is that these are fairly easy steps to demonstrate, like an attendance sheet or a calendar, or even if she's the trainer, then we know it happened. So there, that's a good place to start with something very easy to measure, like training.
Yeah. So that was one of the things that was kind of. It was kind of disheartening. Just think about the progress that we have made over the time since I've been in the role and the technical assistance that's been provided. That was kind of disheartening to see that there was not actual things happening.
Are there any other comments or questions about Chandra's work? Under old business, on pages 130 and 131, there are flyers in the packet, and we've talked about the Disability Resource Expo. That is the flyer on page 130. As a reminder, there's a expo exhibitor meet and greet, which Jim and Barb touched on, Thursday, May 4th at the Vineyard Church at 4 to 6 p.m. And then also a reminder about the Building Inclusive Communities presentation by Dave Weatherow. That will be Friday, May 5th, right here at the Lyle Shields Meeting Room at 1 o'clock in the afternoon.
We set that up as a study session so that if there are members of the Mental Health Board and the DD Board here, we'll do a roll call so you can all be here and share.
Okay,
I'm so sorry. I know we've been here a long time. I was asked on behalf of Linda Tortorelli and Sheila Krein from TAP to just let everybody know about a training that is occurring on May 25th, which is an autism safety training for families and professionals with Dennis DeBott. And so it's really about helping people interact with first responders in a safe way. And that is May 25th from 6:30 till 8 p.m. And it's at the Champaign Police Department on the third floor.
Great, thank you. Okay, as usual, we have meeting schedules on page 132 to 134 and our acronym reminder sheets on pages 135, 136.